Farming, Family, Debt, and Drought, next on Soundings. Hello, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation featuring Dan Butterworth, the author of Waiting for Rain, the story of one farmer's struggle to hold on to a vanishing American dream. Later on the show, a review of a book entitled Second Nature, an account of gardening and its cultural importance. You'll hear from my colleague, Kent Mulliken. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated.
This is a book about the end of a particular farmer's career, although I don't think this is the death knell of all farmers.
Farming is a large part of America's economic and cultural heritage. But for Archie Clare, whose family has worked a portion of land on North Carolina's coastal plain for more than 100 years, the old cycle of plow, plant, and harvest faces an uncertain future. Archie Clare's story is told by Dan Butterworth in his new book, Waiting for Rain. Butterworth follows in the tradition of James Agee, the author of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the classic 1941 chronicle of Southern farm life. Dan Butterworth lived in Archie Clare's house and joined him on his daily circuit. The result is a portrait of a dying way of life. Joining in the following conversation with Dan Butterworth is Richard Schramm, my colleague at the National Humanities Center. I asked Dan Butterworth to read from his book, Waiting for Rain.
Each day, Archie travels a circuit that grounds the various abstractions of bank notices, account summaries, crop certificates, and theories of value in the realities of sandy soil, parched crops, and piney woods, in a world that alternately yields the satisfactions of useful labor and the frustrations of fuzzy conversation, healthy wheat, and exhausted fields.
Dan Butterworth, welcome to Soundings. Who is Archie Clare? Why did you write about this man?
Archie Clare is a farmer who farms about 250 to 300 acres in southern North Carolina, who is struggling with the American struggle these days, I guess, which is to stay alive and make a living and do what he loves to do in times that are very difficult.
Is this a doomsday book? Are you writing about the end of farming as we know it?
Well, in a way, I suppose I am, Wayne. This is a book about the end of a particular farmer's career, although I don't think this is the death knell of all farmers.
Richard Schramm, I want to draw you into the conversation. Part of the publicity on this book, Waiting for Rain, declares that it follows in footsteps no less than those of James Agee and Walker Evans. What about this?
Well, it does, certainly, to some degree. I mean, Dan went and lived with a Southern family and recorded what he saw, recorded his experience with him, and that is, of course, precisely what Agee did with Let Us Now Praise Famous Men in the summer of 1936. So to that extent, the book is definitely in the tradition, and there are similarities. Dan explores in great detail the routine of farming and the life of his character, Archie Clare. He didn't go into as much detail as James Agee did. I mean, he didn't sort through the People's Bureau drawers or anything like that, but he certainly went into a great deal of detail about their lives. There are a number of major differences, though. Agee was central in his book, and he recorded how everything made an impression upon his consciousness. Dan doesn't do that. Archie Clare, his main character, is central to the book. And then Agee also recorded the writing of the book as it was being written, and Dan, of course, didn't do that either. But still, there is a strong family resemblance there, and I must say that that Dan's writing is quite admirable, and I don't know if it's Aegean in many ways, but it's certainly a well-written book, and does a good job describing southeastern North Carolina.
Dan, when you wrote the book, were you writing about, how shall I put this, a sort of concept or a series of events, or did you ground the writing of Waiting for Rain in the people?
Well, I'd have to say that initially, it's grounded in the people. And I took copious notes as I drove around with Archie Clare, as he showed me the farm, as I saw the empty fields and so on. But it became clear to me fairly quickly that there were some nifty controlling metaphors, the whole notion of the circuit, the fact that the kinds of patterns he traces on the ground as he moves from farm to farm have their corollaries in the what I say are the abstractions of bank loans and the government bureaucracy that he has to deal with.
You say that this is almost superseded in the mind of this one farmer, the whole question of that which would be most immediate for a farming family, the seasons themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Farming is a sort of paper activity.
That's right. Well, it's become that.
Uh-huh.
And a guy like Archie Clare, and I think a lot of farmers in North Carolina and throughout the country, deal with the bureaucracy to the extent that they have to. For someone like Archie Clare, farming is still something that you do with your hands. Farming is still something you do on a tractor and so on. But the extent to which these people have to pay attention to the paperwork is a real frustration for them.
Tell me about Archie Clare's hands. At the beginning of the book, you talk about how the sort of governing symbol that you associate with this man is how he fishes for a cigarette in his pocket.
Well, Archie is an amazing man in certain ways. He's very imaginative, and he's also extremely patient, and his hands display his patience. You look at these things, they look like reptiles. They look like, I compare them to swollen roots that have just been pulled from soil. And it's hard to imagine that those hands can do anything. And yet when his hands have a task and they tackle that task, he's very methodical and very graceful.
Uh-huh.
And the same kind of grace and gesture is apparent, say, when he's fishing for keys to find just the right key that fits into that particular padlock. He's very patient in the face of drought, great hardship.
Richard, let's do a little comparative criticism here. How does Archie Clare stack up against some of these characters that A.G. invented? Was it the Gudger family?
Well, he's very different. A.G.'s people, if had A.G. written this book, he would have written about the tenant farmers who work for Archie Clare.
And now Archie is not a tenant.
No, Archie's not a tenant.
He's
a landlord. He rents out the fields to his tenants. A.G.'s people were not landlords. They didn't own very much at all. They were the poorest of the poor during the Great Depression. Archie is very much in the middle class, although you get the impression in the book that he's tenuously clinging to the middle class. And he wouldn't be there on the basis of farming alone. His wife's income, I think, sort of gives the family economy a floor. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah,
so... he's a very different kind of person, and the perspective of the book is very different from that which A.G. wrote.
Yeah, were you after a portrait of the South? I mean, this is a wonderful theme that many writers have come back to time after mm-hmm. time in various forms. What about that?
Well, actually, the manuscript was entitled Farewell Southern Farmer, to begin with. And for one reason or another, that vanished the way farming is. And I did see it as something that had a regional emphasis. For example, consider a Midwestern farmer who's going to not really be able to relate very well to the situation of Archie Clare, where they're farming thousands of acres. But on the other hand, Archie's situation, I think, is fairly typical of the one man or one family farm in North Carolina and states in the region.
Well, what about that title, Waiting for Rain? How important is this event of the drought to the book itself? And how much, in turn, should we read that as a symbol for what mm-hmm. is going on in farming, not only in the South, but all over the country?
That's true. Well, I think that it is a symbol that could evoke lots of potential solutions to the problem of the farmer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is essential to the book because the book is about Archie's decision to stop farming, and ultimately, farmers are still dependent upon the elements. It didn't rain until it was too late to save him. So yeah, waiting for rain. There's a phrase in that part of the state: tobacco will wait for rain. And it's true, tobacco's a weed, and it actually thrives on drought to a certain extent. But after a certain point, if it hasn't rained, then the plant starts dying.
Dan, let me ask you to talk about the way you sort of massage this material. It strikes me that as Archie Clare is to the soil, you are, after a fashion, to your material. I mean, you are artistically shaping this. How much was that kind of thing on your mind as you wrote your book?
Well, it was definitely on my mind. In fact, after two or three chapters, I employ the drought of conversation as a metaphor for what's happening between Archie and I. And he's not very forthcoming a lot of the times. And here we are driving around in 100-degree weather in an air-conditioned car or truck with a stinking dog, you know, in the cab with us. And Archie's not saying anything. I've got my notebook out, and I'm ready to take notes.
How'd you get him to talk?
Well, he's as I said before, he's a very imaginative man. Appeal to his imagination. Hit the right key, and he really comes alive. And often what I found is that you have to appeal to the big picture with Archie Clare. Ask him about what people did in the old days. Ask him what his grandfather did. Ask him who drove these roads that he's driving through these fields 50 years ago, and he becomes very responsive.
How does this kind of writing, Richard, stack up with the sort of thing that you know a lot about? That is A.G. and Evans and the tradition of the artist in the Southern family.
Well, I was going to say that it's kind of surprising to hear Dan say that Archie Clare was not very forthcoming, because his voice is dominant in the book, and he will go on for page after page in great detail about the raising of tobacco or about his family heritage. In fact, you know, just as you learn more about whales than you ever wanted to know in Moby Dick, you learn more about tobacco growing than you probably ever wanted to know in Waiting for Rain. In fact, Dan will take us, there's no criticism of his writing, he will take us to the very verge of tedium and then make his point, and that sort of rescues a lot of the real precise detail that went before. But he clearly had a pattern in mind, and that pattern comes through in a very well-designed, well-shaped book.
Are you writing, as it were, history from a contemporary standpoint, Dan? I mean, educating your readers about what it means to be a farmer in the South?
I do think it's important for people to figure out what their neighbors are up to. And, you know, this is part of our national myth, the business of farming. I think it's important for people who don't really understand what it's like day in, day out, to get a taste of that. But I also think that any regional, any look into what happens in a particular region, any examination of the life of the little guy is valuable and interesting to us.
Richard?
Yeah, I was struck by Dan's phrase there, the business of farming. And one of the things that really jumped out at me in this book was the extent to which we have made something as elemental, and I mean that in all sorts of ways, as elemental as farming into an abstraction. Mm. That at one point, Archie Clare says that really your profit doesn't matter. What you have out in the field really doesn't affect your profit. You could have an empty field and have a good year, and have a bumper crop and have a bad year. This is particularly important, I think, for Southern farmers, because critics have long noted the concreteness of Southern culture because it was rooted in agriculture and in rural communities. And a lot of critics have said this is what accounts for the richly detailed textures of Southern literature, as opposed to the more abstract textures of other kinds of literature. And yet here now in the South, we see this elemental profession rendered abstract.
You've also got the family as a large emblem in Southern literature. How directly or indirectly, Dan, are you commenting on the rise, the fall, the status of the family in the South?
Well, I think my experience with these people is that the family is going the way of farming and the way of the land, and that is land gets distributed, and the big farms are broken down as they're handed down through the generations, and so farming has died out of Archie Clare's family as his children have dispersed. You know, in a lot of the fairly isolated rural areas, in this culture, in contemporary culture, why would the children stay?
Yeah.
And Archie Clare's children do not stay. They all move on.
So this is a book about what, the nationalization of Dixie, or at least one important element of Dixie, that is to say the farm and the family farm?
Well, it could be, but I would never make the claim. In fact, I try to conclude the book with a suggestion that really all I can affirm here is that I've seen the demise of a particular farmer. They keep coming. They keep figuring out ways to maintain a relationship with the land.
Uh-huh.
And it may be that they end up sheetrocking for 4 days a week, or it could be that they have a shift at the cannery. But the new farmers at the family level tend to support their farming now with other occupations.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that farming is really going to disappear, but uh-huh. I do think that the particular nuances of a certain way of farming and a family's relationship with the process of farming and so on, I think those things do change.
Richard, again, you know a lot about Southern literature, particularly at the time of the Depression, James Agee and Walker Evans. Did Walker Evans and James Agee, in effect, predict Archie Clare in Let Us Now Praise Famous Men? Is that the thread that we're following here?
No, I don't think that Famous Men was a book that looked forward much at all. It was it was very, very focused on the present, and of course, the main Agee's point of view in there was looking back. I mean, he was exploring his own past, which he discovered there in Alabama. So I really don't think that he was looking forward. He was, to some extent, he may have been, because he was predicting that the South would change as people like him, bearers of the 20th century, and New Dealers and other folks like that came in and tried to improve it. Their conscious efforts didn't have much effect. It was the rise of the economy after World War II that changed things, and the roads that destroyed the isolation of places like southeastern North Carolina. What struck me about Dan's book is that that Archie Clare does manage to stay on the land. I anticipated that at the end of the book we were going to see Archie go off and work at a cannery or a chicken processing plant or something like that. Instead, he takes up logging. So it shows, I think Dan's point is well taken, that it shows that these people are going to maintain some relationship with the land. So I don't think you're going to see the rural South dying out. I think there's a tough vein of people there who are going to cling to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost expect Archie's son to come back.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, these are old home places that have a very, very strong pull. And there's always going to be some kind of life there on the land. And it's going to be profoundly influenced by I-95 and other creatures of the 20th century, but there's still going to be something there. And it'll be distinctively Southern in some fashion. I don't know mm-hmm. what, but it'll be distinctively Southern.
Well, let me give you the last word, Dan. What's next for Archie and Waynette? I love that great name, Waynette. what's next for the Clares?
Well, Archie continues to log, and he has a one-man operation. I don't know if you've seen anything like that, but it's pretty hair-raising thing. I mean, he actually...
Dangerous.
Very dangerous. Well, in fact, a log mm-hmm. fell on him, and he bent a vertebrae. But Waynette has retired, and Archie is in a kind of semi-retirement right now. But he is, he's slowing down. He hangs around the house a lot more than usual, and it's, I'm not exactly sure what the future holds. He has explored some, he's made some attempts to take other jobs, and none of them have succeeded. He's not interested.
But you're going to stay in touch with these characters.
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, Dan, I want to thank you for your participation on Soundings. Richard Schramm, colleague here at the Humanities Center. Dan Butterworth, your book is Waiting for Rain. It's available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. You are a professor at Morehead State University over
yes.
in Kentucky.
Soon moving to Gonzaga University.
All right, up yeah. in Washington State. Uh-huh. Well, thanks for coming by. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond.
Gardens teach the necessary, if un-American, lesson that there might be some middle ground between the lawn and the forest, between those who would complete the conquest of the planet in the name of progress, and those who believe it's time we abdicated our rule and left the earth in the care of its more innocent species. The garden suggests there might be a place where we can meet nature halfway.
My colleague Kent Mulliken of the National Humanities Center reading from Second Nature, recently published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. The author of Second Nature is Michael Pollan, executive editor of Harper's Magazine. According to Kent Mulliken, Pollan is both a well-informed gardener and a first-rate writer, a combination of skills he brings to bear in Second Nature. The book's subtitle is A Gardener's Education.
In Second Nature, Pollan relates some of the lessons he learned as he set out to transform 5 acres of rundown Connecticut farm into a pleasing landscape. But this book concerns much more than horticulture. It is about culture in broader terms, why we think as we do, what we've inherited from our intellectual predecessors, and what we will leave to our successors. Pollan comments in his introduction, "I soon came to the realization that I would not learn to garden very well before I had also learned about a few other things, about my proper place in nature, about the somewhat peculiar attitudes toward the land that an American is born with, about the troubled borders between nature and culture, and about the experience of place, the moral implications of landscape design, and several other questions that the wish to harvest a few decent tomatoes had not prepared me for." The charm of Pollan's book lies in his contemplation of these questions as he works his land. He gardens as a man thinking. That, of course, is Ralph Waldo Emerson's famous definition of the American scholar. But you don't get very far into Second Nature before you discover that Pollan has bones to pick with Emerson, Thoreau, and their brand of American Romanticism, in which nature and culture are in opposition. Thoreau felt guilty about chopping the weeds in his bean field. Pollan argues that this habit of thought is by now so deep in the American grain that to this day, when we imagine wilderness and cultivated land, we privilege wilderness without hesitation. It's pure, sublime, morally superior. Or is it? Pollan invites us to think twice about that choice, and in place of Thoreau's stark contrast, he urges us to imagine the harmonious relationship of nature and culture that for him defines a garden. But Second Nature is much more than a polemic aimed at Thoreau and Emerson. Pollan's argument, really a lover's quarrel, combines graceful narrative, entertaining anecdote, learned allusion, and clever insight as he conducts us through the 4 seasons of a gardener's year. He devotes chapters along the way to such staples of gardening lore as doing battles with animal and insect marauders, the care and feeding of the lawn, the culture of roses, and how to plant a tree. But while these subjects are the ordinary fare of the gardening manual, Pollan's treatment of them is extraordinary. There is plenty of practical advice in the book, but the real interest lies in the author's reflections, and in this he resembles Thoreau, whom we read much more for the distinctive flavor of a mind than for natural history. Thus, we welcome Pollan's interrupting a step-by-step account of planting a maple tree with allusions, apt and not pedantic, to William James, the Christian tradition, New England Puritanism, Walt Whitman, Washington Irving, and the etymological relation of tree to truth. If you enjoy this kind of reflective detour, you'll like this book. Pollan's style is witty, and as one might expect of a professional editor, he is fascinated by language. This leads to nice conceits like, "If lawn mowing feels like copying the same sentence over and over, gardening is like writing out new ones, an infinitely variable process of invention and discovery." And then there's his wry Jeremiad on the American lawn. "Another day it occurred to me that time as we know it doesn't exist in the lawn, since the grass never dies or is allowed to flower and set seed. Lawns are nature purged of sex or death. No wonder Americans like them so much. This year, we're looking back on the westward voyage of Columbus and on all that followed the settlement of Europeans upon what Scott Fitzgerald termed the green breast of the New World. Moreover, 1992 has seen the first global conference on the state of the environment. So it's not a bad time for Americans to give some thought to our relationship with nature. And one could do a lot worse than reading Michael Pollan's book, Second Nature. This is Kent Mulliken at the National Humanities Center.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's show. The speakers were Dan Butterworth, Richard Schramm, and Kent Mulliken. Dan Butterworth's new book is Waiting for Rain, available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Kent Mulliken reviewed Michael Pollan's book, Second Nature, published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. Send $5 for a cassette copy of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The program number this week is 633. That's number 633, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. The Center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, conversations about Scandinavian myth and about ritual and religion in ancient Greek culture. My guests will be Margaret Clunies Ross of the University of Sydney and Stephen Lonsdale of Davidson College. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. This week on Soundings, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Dan Butterworth of Gonzaga University discusses Waiting for Rain, his chronicle of farming and the American dream. You'll also hear a review of Second Nature, a new book about gardening and American culture. Working the Land, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.